units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Scotty's on fire.
Scotty's on fire in Russia. The first ever edition of Ask the Inspector with the favorite weapons inspector abroad. And you're looking good, Scott. How you feeling?
I'm good. I'm tired. I mean, it was a long trip here, and we've been very, very active, but it's been worth every second. Yeah.
Well, we're watching the photos come in on Telegram and elsewhere. We saw you posing with your lovely daughter, Vika. And where was that?
Irkutsk. I love Irkutsk.
I knew that's what it meant. Come on.
You knew it.
And can we say where you are now or not?
I'm still in Irkutsk. I'll be here for another day. And I have to tell you, I mean, you know, I knew this trip was going to be something else, but the insights that you get, you know, I don't consider myself to be ignorant about Russia, but you know, I'll just say straight up that you know, this has just been an eye-opening experience in terms of the history. I mean, I'm a Russian historian, and yesterday I was being, you know, I'm just learning so much. The culture, you know, I'm with the
Novosibirsk. Well, is part of it because things have changed a lot since you were there, or you're becoming?
Well, an interesting aspect of it is that, you know, I studied history back when it was the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And so you were limited, especially if you used, you know, Soviet sources, you were limited to a Soviet perspective on things such as the Civil War, the Revolution, etc. Here in Irkutsk, it's clear to me that there is no love for the Soviet period. They are re-embracing their Imperial Russian past. I was at the site where Kolchak, who was a white admiral, was killed during the Civil War, and there's a statue to him. And I said, you know, that, you know, from the perspective that I have from history, that he was a fairly bad man. And they're like, no, he's one of the greatest Russians ever, etc. And then I listened to him, and I realized that, you know, while I'm not going to embrace, you know, their historical theory, I realize that there's another perspective out there that has to be considered, and that, you know, and so, you know, one of my new missions is to re-examine the life of Admiral Kolchak and try and see, you know, take advantage of new sources. And that's the thing, you know, this is the home of the Decembrists. You know, they were sent to exile here, and I went to the museum, and again, new perspectives, because we're dealing with a post-Soviet reality. But then there's the contrast that, you know, I went to the Memorial Park, and they have a live honor guard there. 200,000 citizens of Irkutsk fought in World War II, and most of them didn't come home. And there's a monument there for those who sacrificed. And that monument's been manned constantly. The eternal light is eternally lit by people who, cadets, who volunteer and have to try out. This is an honor to stand there for 2-3 hours at a time in respect. And the silence of the citizens as they go by. So, you know, here's the Great Patriotic War and the absolute reverence they have for the citizens who sacrificed so much. But anybody who sits here and says that, you know, Vladimir Putin is trying to reconstitute the Soviet Union, they don't have a clue what they're talking about. And that's, you know, I always knew that, but I mean, it just becomes so much more obvious here. And the same thing about culture. I mean, in Novosibirsk, they have an opera house that's the largest in Russia, one of the largest in the world. We were given a wonderful tour there. They're in the process of preparing three separate major, you know, ballets, orchestras, etc. The quality of the people there, you know, the musicians, the conductors, etc. They can compete and probably prevail against the best the United States has to offer. And I mean that. You can take the New York, you know, the New York Philharmonic. These guys got them. The ballet, these guys got them. And this is in Siberia, where people are like, ah, they just wrestle bears. You know, well, no, they don't. And here's the other.
Tell them all about your wanting to get in touch with your inner Van Cliburn.
They respect that a lot. They actually quote that a lot. That's an important theme for them. They understand it. They get it.
So they knew you were saying that before you arrived.
Oh yeah, no. They, Jeff, there ain't no secrets here. They all watch this show. They watch everything. They know everything.
All right, that's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing at all. Hi everybody in Russia. How you doing?
These people can quote me better than I can quote me. But the last observation I'll put out there on sanctions. Hey, Blinken, Biden, it ain't going to work. These guys got you beat. Novosibirsk is a business incubator. Again, it's in Siberia. Most Americans are like, no, well, where? Novosibirsk, guys, third largest city in Russia, biggest growing economy in Russia. It's a business incubator. And they're bringing business in from everywhere in the world, and they've recovered. It was a punch in the face when the sanctions came in, but they picked themselves, dust themselves off, and they're moving on. And nothing we do is going to impact that. Nothing we do is going to impact that.
Is this Novosibirsk in this photo?
This is Novosibirsk.
Everybody's talking about the translator. She had a really tough job. I'd say 80% of the comments are very, maybe 90% of the comments are positive. 10% are complaining that she's missing things. But
it's
an impossible job.
I am the worst person in the world to translate for. First of all, I speak too fast. I use a lot of jargon. And then I'm very inconsiderate, even though I want to be considerate. I oftentimes speak too long. And see, she has a notepad there. She's taking copious notes as I speak. Yeah, I know. And then she refers back to them. She was actually, for the people who criticize her, she is one of the most highly trained translators. She went to all the right schools, including GIMO, which is the elite diplomatic school for linguistics. She's graduated from Moscow State University, Novosibirsk State University. She is eminently qualified. And for all the people out there criticizing her, guys, it's an impossible task, and she did a hell of a job.
Yeah, that's how it looked to me. I mean, I don't know Russian, so what do I know? But it seemed like she was doing a great job, and it seemed like a very, very difficult job. Is she going to be your translator throughout the whole tour, or are there going to be different translators?
No, each area is responsible for organizing events and providing the translator. So she was the translator for Novosibirsk. She did two sessions there, and like I said, she was just fantastic. And if she's watching, thank you very much.
Good job. Now, what about when you go out to the museums and things like that, when you're going out and about apart from the events? Is she or some sort of translator with you, or is that also different people switching off? How do you?
No, we have my hosts, Alexander and Ilya. Alexander is the genius behind this. I have to just say this. This guy's a dynamo, and if he whatever he wants to accomplish, he's going to accomplish it. This guy apparently this tour, nobody believed it could be done. Every time he told somebody that this is what he was planning, everybody, and I mean everybody from the highest level down, was like, that ain't gonna happen. Never gonna happen. Well, it's happened.
What were the obstacles that they detected or believed they detected?
Well, the first obstacle was they never thought I'd come. They were just like, "You're not going to come." What American in his craziest mind would ever come over here now in this period of time? So that's the first thing they said.
Oh, they don't understand that you're hungering for this reaction.
Yeah.
I got in trouble with a bunch of people in the audience. They thought that remember my crack about how he's gay, and they took that as homophobic, and they used as ammunition. They said that even Scott agrees, but he I don't know for sure if he was, but he is believed to be gay. I was simply pointing out the irony of these women lusting for a guy who was not interested in women. That's all.
They're lusting for his mind.
Okay.
No, I say that as I have to tell you. I mean, it boggles me, but. I'm being greeted everywhere, recognized in the streets. It's very humbling. It's a little bit intimidating because I went out in the morning just for a morning walk, and I'm just wandering down the streets and people come up, oh, Scott Ritter, how you doing? You know, and there's a million and a half selfies out there right now. I'm on everybody's phone right now.
So, you have to allow for some extra time just to do an errand or to go somewhere, because every time it takes
I think my organizers are realizing that they have to allow for extra time for the book signing. I think they just assumed that I was going to open a book, sign it, shut the book. But I try to put a personal note in there. But then there's also the obligatory, you know, exchange of greetings, and then the photograph and all that. So the book signing, the physical act of signing the book, it takes about four times longer than what they wanted. And that's okay if you're calculating, you know, 5 seconds for signing a book, now it takes 20 seconds. But when you stretch that out for the entire thing, if they allocated an hour for book signing, oh no, it's going to be a little bit longer than that, guys. And I've got to work on it, but how can you say no to people who show up? I mean, they come here, they're very polite. They listen, they ask great questions. I mean, that's the thing about it. It's sort of like a mini Ask the Inspector. They turn it over to the audience almost immediately, and there's some great questions out there. And this has just been a fantastic opportunity. And Vika loves it too. I mean, she's,
that's what I was going to ask. Does she get a kick out of seeing her father adored by the fans, or is she like, he's my father?
No, good Lord, no, she doesn't get a kick out of it. She jumps in and humiliates me all she can. She asked a question out of the blue, and the thing, of course, when my daughter puts her hands up, I gotta, you know, say, so she jammed me with a question that made me think and stumble and all that. But you know, that's really what her job is to make life hard for her father. No, but I think she's enjoying the heck out of this. This is I am so glad that she was able to come on this trip and to experience this. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity. The hosts are unbelievable. As I said, nobody thought it could be done. The hardest part was getting me here, but once they got me here, making it happen. I mean, the logistics of this is mind-boggling logistics, and it's being pulled off seamlessly. I mean, wow.
What about the film crew? Got to ask you about the film crew and Vika. Are you getting some good footage for this documentary?
Vika's doing her job, and the film crew is working.
They're working. Okay, sounds like you're choosing your words carefully.
I think there's going to, it's a work in progress, and it'll get better as the thing. Look, I'm not being critical of anybody, and I can't be critical of anybody. Everybody here is doing this out of the kindness of their heart and all that. And so there's no such thing as an inadequate response. This is a learning thing. Just like I have to learn every day, you know, how to adjust, you know, to reality, you know, like book signing. I can't be so greedy in terms of, I have to respect their time, you know, and things like that. It's just a learning process. I don't think anybody, you know, professional film crews, I can guarantee you this. We could have brought over the best LA documentary crew, and they'd be stumbling and fumbling too. All right. This is something that you can't plan for. It's all spontaneous. It's spur of the moment. And everybody's doing a great job. Everybody's doing a great job.
Right.
We will make a movie that will be fantastic with what we're going to get.
What about, a lot of folks are saying, boy, it doesn't look like we can get into these events. It's very controlled. Is there anything you can say to folks who want to get into these events as to how they could maybe make themselves
eligible? Yeah, this is the toughest part. That's why they did the live streaming. And, you know, I don't want to talk about security too much, but there's a legitimate security concern. They're not, and I don't want to make it seem like Russia's dangerous, because Russia's not dangerous. Russia's very, very safe.
But tell that to the Kremlin.
Well, there's the point. They, you know, there's a drone strike on the Kremlin, and you know, people who mean to do harm will. There it is. Boom. People who mean to do harm will pick soft targets, pick easy targets, I'm a soft, easy target on this tour. I mean, you know, we're doing stuff. So it's not just about protecting me. It's about protecting everybody else involved, the audience especially. You don't want to invite people to something only to something horrible happen. So
yeah, I think, you know, most people understand why the security is what it is. I'm just asking, is there a way for folks who want to attend to make themselves eligible, or it's all kind of who you know kind of a thing?
You know, it's not who you, well, I mean, there's a little bit of that, but it's, let's just say that it's a, they do things to ensure security. And one of the things they do is to make sure that it's not widely advertised for everybody, because even if you can't get in, if you arrive, things can happen. I mean, if a bad person knows where something's happening, things can happen. It's not just about, you know, getting to me. If you get to the event, you disrupt this. So they're being, and plus, you know, like somebody leaked the, you know, leaked a version of the itinerary. So it's all over the internet right now. And, you know, we, and so there had to be adjustments made. And so people have to understand that, that, you know, let's say that there was a plan A that people were going to do. Plan A doesn't exist anymore. Plan B went in. In some cases, plan B doesn't exist. It's that kind of stuff. And again, I don't want to be, make people think that this is a paranoid thing. It's not. This is wonderful. This is open. This is thing. But for the security of, you know, of everybody involved, especially the people that, that would be invited to this, it's not, unfortunately, there's, it's not going to be as open as I would like, the organizers would like, or people would like. That's just one of the unfortunate realities of the time we live in. And again, if you're not looking at that Kremlin strike and understanding that that the Ukrainians will go to any lengths to score a political propaganda victory, then your head's not screwed on right.
All right, well, this is Ask the Inspector, so let's go to questions from our beloved audience. We have a few that were submitted in advance, and then we're going to take some live questions as well coming in on YouTube and Facebook. Anne Moss, on short notice, is with us, and she is curating the questions backstage, and we thank her for her assistance. The first question comes from Alex in Belgrade. Can a drone over the Kremlin be a false flag operation? Does Russia need an excuse for something after all the terrorist attacks on new Russian territories, as well as on territories recognized by the USA as the Russian Federation?
Look, anything is possible. But let's just be clear here. The Ukrainians said they were going to do this. All right, they straight up said they were going to do this. They said, we're going to put a drone in the Kremlin on Victory Day. We're going to attack the Kremlin. That's what they said. Now they've done it. Now the drone's hit. So it's like Joe Biden. I'm going to take out Nord Stream 2 if the Russians go into Ukraine. Russians go into Ukraine, Nord Stream 2 taken out. Who did it? Joe Biden confessed. The Ukrainians have confessed. Now people say, well, what should Russia do? I'm not a Russian. But I'll tell you this. If a state party said, we're going to hit the White House with a drone, and then the White House gets hit by a drone, that state party won't exist anymore. Don't you understand that? I hope people understand that. That if a drone hit the White House, those who sent the drone to the White House will not be living. End of story. So it's hypocritical to not think that Russia feels the same way. The Kremlin was hit. The Kremlin was hit. Putin's residence was hit. The seat of government was hit. If you don't understand the scope and scale of what that represents, you know, they didn't destroy the Kremlin, but they struck the Kremlin. And I think we should stand by. Only Russia can decide how Russia will respond. But I know how America would respond, and I think it's only logical to believe that the Russians might be thinking the same way.
All right, here is Zelensky denying it.
Very easy.
President Zelensky, you said, or perhaps...
Why would they accuse Ukraine of this at this moment?
You know, I can repeat this message, and I think it will at least will be understandable for everybody. We don't attack Putin or Moscow. We fight on our territory. We are defending our villages and cities. We don't have, you know, enough weapon for this. That's why we don't use it anywhere. For us, that is the deficit. We can't spend it. And we didn't attack Putin. We leave it to tribunal.
It's because of a lack of ammunition that we should believe that they didn't do it. That was not the excuse that I expected to hear.
That's dead man talking. I have no use for that guy. I mean, enjoy the videos while you can, because I think pretty soon he won't be making videos.
All right, let's move on to our next question. This is from Timur in the town you just left. I know it's early, but after a few tour meetings and two cities, do you have a feeling that the Russian people are willing to participate in the initiative to discuss nuclear disarmament, considering that this type of weapon is the only reason stopping direct military hostility from the West?
My initial take, and Timur, that's a very good question, but my initial take is this. There is no appetite for nuclear disarmament right now, given the reality of the circumstances. What Timur said is 100% correct, and I acknowledge this. If it weren't for Russia's nuclear arsenal, the conflict in Ukraine would be far different than it is right now. It would be a direct conflict between NATO and Russia that would be extending beyond the borders of Ukraine. The only thing that prevents that is that Russia would view that kind of a confrontation as a potential existential confrontation that would trigger a nuclear response. And the West understands what that means. And so instead we have this proxy conflict where the West is doing everything but sending their troops in. So I don't think right now there's any appetite for nuclear disarmament. But I do get the feeling that the Russians are cognizant of the fact that this is not a situation that's sustainable, that this kind of high tension, conflict between Russia and the collective West, both nuclear armed powers, has the potential of spinning out of control, and that means the end of the world. And they get it. They understand that. So I do believe that there is a desire in a post-Ukraine conflict, if a new European security framework could be established like Russia wants, if dialogue could be initiated between Russia and the United States, that a process can be resumed that talks about arms control and the potential for nuclear disarmament. So they believe in the concept and the premise, but now is not the right time.
Eric Kilpatrick from Charleston, West Virginia. Why is it that all I hear about is a fourth generation jet being sent to Ukraine? Why not our F-22s and 35 or F-18s? Are they not as capable as the F-16? And or what is the issue about using these jets and Ukraine, understanding that they will have to have U.S. pilots?
Well, first of all, no one's going to say if an F-22, F-35 or F-18 goes to Ukraine, it's going to be flown by a U.S. pilot. And that means war between the United States and Russia. And, nobody's asking for that right now. Nobody's pushing for that. The F-16, the F-16 is flown by a number of nations. And so the idea is that the Ukrainians will be able to transition to the F-16. It's an unrealistic expectation. The Ukrainians wouldn't be able to transition to the F-16 in an operationally meaningful fashion. But this is, pushing for the F-16 is a way of saying, allowing people to say, oh, well, Ukraine could have won, except for the fact they didn't get the F-16s. If we had only given them the F-16s, then they wouldn't have lost this war. But look, if they got the F-16s, there'd just be a bunch of blown up F-16s. It's not going to change what's going on the ground in Ukraine today.
All right. Ben Taher from Libya. Recently, the Russians used Tu-95 and Tu-160 strategic bombers in the last strike on Ukraine. Does that mean the Russians have air superiority all over Ukraine now? And if that's the case, are we going to see the next generation of jet fighters being used from now on? Well, our audience sure knows a lot about equipment.
Russia already has air superiority all over Ukraine. What air superiority means is that you can impose your will at a given time and given place without fear of adequate interdiction. Meaning, if Russia wants to blow up target A, they can using air power. It doesn't mean that Russian airplanes can loiter over Ukraine. It doesn't mean that Ukraine doesn't have air defense. It means that Russia is able to overcome all of Ukraine's air defense to impose its will as required on any aspect of the battlefield. Air supremacy, as opposed to air superior, air supremacy means you can go anywhere you want, fly anywhere you want without any fear of anything, that there's no contested airspace. There's still contested airspace in Ukraine. Ukraine still puts fighter planes up in the air. They still have air defense in certain areas. But Russia is able to overcome all those and impose its will. And that's what air superiority is. And you know, that's that. You know, whether Russia is going to send in, you know, new generation fire, that's up to them. But you have to ask yourself why, to what end? If you already have the ability to put weapon A on target B, no matter what, you don't need to bring in all your toys. And in some cases, you want to hold some of these toys in reserve because you don't want to give away all your capabilities. Russia is still sitting on a tremendous arsenal of weaponry and technology that has not been brought to the Ukrainian battlefield because they understand the potential for follow-on conflict with NATO, and you don't want to give away all your, you know, show all your cards.
A name we'll all recognize, those of you who are regular viewers, Jackie Le Chevalier from Argentina. Would it help if people from all around the world sent messages to the Russian people encouraging them to support Scott's project? I'd certainly write something for Scott to carry with him during his tour. What do you think?
Well, Jackie, thank you very much for the sentiment and the offer. You don't need to, from what I'm understanding, you don't need to encourage this. This is, again, this has been one of the most heartwarming aspects of this tour, is the absolute, love. I mean, but not, you know, not romantic love. I'm talking about love, genuine human love, kindness. This the way the Russians have opened up their hearts on this tour. They don't need encouragement to do this. They are already doing this. What they need is partnership. They need people to the Russians feel very isolated right now. That's something that I have picked up on, and it hurts because these are good people. These are really, really good people, and I think they're frustrated and they're hurt by the way the West has rejected them, and it's generating some anger and resentment on the part of Russians. I mean, I'll give you an example. In Novosibirsk, I went to the academic city outside of Novosibirsk, where all the universities and sort of a research park. And they have a wonderful, they have an archway coming in, and they call it the geese, the two geese, because it looks like two geese with their heads coming together. A great over thing with, I mean, they've got glass floors, so you walk over and you're looking down, looks like you're falling through, it's pretty intimidating. But but beneath it, they have this wonderful restaurant bar, and it's got a giant brewery in the back. Jeff, we'd like this place. and they brew, I mean, like I have 16 different kinds of beer right there. And but you know, they have this they have this beer festival every year where they invite the best craft beer makers in the world to come in. And this is the perfect venue for American craft beer, you know, American craft beer brewers to come in and exchange ideas, celebrate life, do this. Everybody from around the world comes to this place, and from around Russia comes to this place in it's in June, I think. And you know, they've built this wonderful bar, and they have photographs of Americans, you know, memorabilia, you know, the 50s, the actors and all this Hollywood stars and around there, and they play the greatest soundtrack. I mean, this is, you know, classic rock, all American rock. And they're there, and you just say, this is the perfect place for Americans to come and enjoy. There's no Americans there. And here's the thing. They sit there now, they listen to the music, they eat the food, they look at the photographs, but they're beyond that now. They're talking about the Chinese, they're talking about the Iranians, they're talking about, you know, the Indians, they're talking about anybody but America. They're talking about all the people that are coming in and working with. And while there might be some anger and resentment in their hearts, they're living life and they're doing good. They're doing great. I mean, again, anybody thinks sanctions is going to hurt these people, you haven't a clue what you're talking about. These guys are industrious, they're hardworking, they're innovative, they're cutting edge, they're everything you want. You know, oh, they don't have the computer chip. They got the computer chips. They got everything. And they got brains that work. And they're doing quite well. But it was just sad because I'm sitting there saying, this would be a perfect place for an Oregon.
Well, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but I know not everybody there speaks English. So what's the deal on pumping American rock tunes one after the other? They just kind of like...
They like the music.
Just the feel of it, even if they don't understand the lyrics.
Well, you know, a lot of people speak English, but you don't have to speak English to enjoy good music. But again, it's the vibe. The vibe of this place was supposed to be, they were supposed to basically replicate an American microbrewery. And so that's what they did. They built an American microbrewery in Novosibirsk that creates great beer, a whole bunch of different IPAs, wheat beer, everything. And yet now America's opted out. America's opted out. And so they're moving on. They're living life. They haven't stopped living. It's not like, oh, no, the Americans aren't coming. We must shut up and not do it. No, it's like, darn, would have been nice if the Americans were here, but we're gonna get on with our lives. And that's the thing. Hey, America, we're being left behind. We're being left behind, and we don't want to be left behind. Okay, we need to be in here. We need to be working with these people in a cooperative fashion. They don't need us to succeed. This isn't the 1990s where everybody's waiting for America to arrive to save the day. This ain't about saving the day, guys. This is about learning from these people. These Russians are doing things that could benefit the United States, and there's no reason why we shouldn't have our business leaders in here learning from these people, adapting, you know, some of their technologies and techniques and methodologies and bringing home to America and help make America a better place to live.
Such an important point. I hope that the people who need to hear that hear it. Camilla Brodersen from Denmark. For the sake of getting to know our Russian brethren better, speaking of which, you were just talking about that, my boyfriend and I started watching Russian movies. In Moscow does not believe in tears. There's a scene with a man and woman talking after the man had left her and then returned. They drink heavily, bang a dried fish on the table, and put their hands on top of the fish. What's with the fish? Do you know anything about this?
I mean, I'm familiar with the scene. I can't get it. I don't know. This is why I'm in Russia. I'm trying to learn questions about what's with the fish. I know that Russians love herring. They love fish. But I don't know what the symbology of that is. I don't know. I just don't know. I'll find out.
Can you make that one of your journalistic goals to find out the answer to that?
I promise that I will find out the answer, if an answer exists to that.
Oh, it could be just a big...
I don't know.
All right. I just made a note.
But it's a great movie, by the way. It's a great movie. I strongly recommend the movie. And if you're a lady or a man prone to tears, bring a box of Kleenex.
Okay. Buck Rogers from Singapore. Thanks to everybody making the donations, by the way. We see it. We appreciate it. What are three futuristic game-changing weapons or technologies of war that come to your mind? Why? Because you asked, Buck. That's why.
I think, drones have already made their appearance, and they're just going to become more innovative and I think you're going to see drones integrated into, more aspects of war. Electronic warfare is very important. And it's not just with drones, but it's everything. We're so digitally, interconnected. To jam that, to be able to prevent that kind of connectivity is essential in modern war. And then I'm just going to go caveman on you. I think this war has shown that maybe the most important factor is the man on the ground, the boots on the ground, that no amount of technology makes up for the fact that you have to have blood, flesh, and bone on the battlefield, doing the heavy lifting, the dying, the suffering, the fighting, the killing. And so no amount of technology will ever replace that. And so that's it. I think, and to be honest, drones can get shot down, electronic warfare can be jammed on its own self. But, you know, you're never going to be able to replace the common soldier on the battlefield. And I think that this war proves that more than anything else. A lot of times people talk about tanks, artillery, this and that. It's the man in the weapon, the man behind the weapon, the man on the ground that that ultimately is going to win or lose a war.
Well, your third example relates to your first example, which is drones. We've talked about this in previous episodes, and it's well known that I'm the idiot here and you're the expert. But this idiot is not too much of an idiot to realize that drones are relatively inexpensive. We just saw what happened at the Kremlin. And, you know, nefarious characters are everywhere. And I don't want to be Debbie Downer or anything, but I don't know. You got to be worried about, you know, where and when they can strike. That wasn't a terribly big explosion at the Kremlin, but it sure would be big enough if it hit somebody.
Yep. No, I mean, it's there. But for every drone attacker, there's now going to be counter-drone people out there. And, you know, the people who are using the drones are going to become hunted. And it's just, again, what history shows is that for every weapon, there's a counter to the weapon. Mm. Nobody's found a way to replace the man on the ground.
Okay. Brian Egger from Wales. Next year, there will be elections in Taiwan, and it seems likely the pro-China party might win. Will this be allowed to happen? And if it does, what might be the outcome?
Well, one, I agree with you. In November 2024, there will be elections in Taiwan, and it does seem likely that the Kuomintang party, the current opposition party, might prevail. If it happens, it's a game changer because U.S. policy with Taiwan goes down the drain. It's the end of the hypocrisy of America's one China policy where we say one thing but we do another. I think you'll see Taiwan gravitating towards China, and that's all she wrote for America's policy. So now, with that at stake, will it be allowed to happen? The United States is going to do everything possible to make sure that doesn't happen. I can guarantee you the CIA is working overtime inside Taiwan, trying to buy off people to compromise candidates. So, because that's what the CIA does for a living. Don't ever listen to Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and Joe Biden talking about the importance of unfettered democracy. We don't believe in unfettered democracy. We skew the game here at home, and we interfere abroad. That's what we do, and it actually destroys the credibility of anybody who is promoting democracy, because it's clear to just about everybody who watches that democracy exists in name only. It doesn't exist in reality on the ground, especially when the CIA and the U.S. government's involved.
Okay. I see a lot of our friends are watching and donating as well. Thank you, Liz Hill. Thank you, Carl. Thank you, Arcadi. Thank you, Ricardo. Sorry if I missed anybody there, but just want you to know it's very heartwarming to know that you guys follow us every step of the way. And let's take one more question of the ones that were submitted in advance, and then Anne will go to some live questions so we can start lining those up. That would be great. Dave from Ontario. Caleb Maupin is a well-read guy who knows how to sell his gospel, which makes sense, by the way. Most of his followers, though, look like members of the Heralds of the Red Dawn from the Jeeves and Wooster episode, Comrade Bingo. What do you think of their political potential? By the way, I'm not at all familiar with the reference, but I'm pretty sure that's not a compliment.
No, I'm pretty sure. You know, if we're going to believe in democratic potential, meaning that we got to get enough citizens active, involved, engaged to make a difference, to have a potential of swaying an election about issues like disarmament and arms control, you do so one vote at a time. I don't think there's any politician out there that doesn't understand the importance of that. And especially when we're trying to be a big tent movement, meaning that we want everybody, because nuclear weapons is the great uniter. And what I mean by that is we're all going to die. I don't care if you're a character from the program you decided, or you look like Tucker Carlson back when he wore a bow tie, or, you know, it doesn't matter. you're all going to die. So I need everybody who, I almost knocked over a soda there, everybody who potentially, who is a potential victim, to come together. So I think Caleb's awesome because Caleb taps into a particular dynamic, a particular constituency. And that constituency isn't insignificant. It shouldn't be minimized or denigrated. They're fellow citizens, fellow human beings whose lives are as important as everybody's life. And I think it's awesome that Caleb can speak in a way that motivates these people. And if Caleb can bring these people into the tent to help us with our mission, I'm all for it. I'm not going to mock anybody. I mean, because look at me. People can just mock me all they want, and some do. But it doesn't mean that my vote is any less significant as anybody else's vote. One vote right. at a time.
There's an old saying, politics makes for strange bedfellows. And that's a good name for our new podcast, by the way. How's that for a segue? Sometimes my segues are terrible. What's that?
The people who stole my time slot.
Yeah, right. This Friday night, in our usual Ask the Inspector time slot, Scott is worried that he's going to lose it to these people. But the sentiment that Scott was just expressing is really the inspiration behind this concept, Strange Bedfellows. So I hope you guys will check this out Friday night, our usual time slot, 8 p.m. Eastern time. While Scott is in Russia, they'll be in that time slot. And when he comes back, even though he was worried about losing it, that's not true at all. He will get his time slot back, and we'll find another time slot for them. So hopefully you'll check that out. Also, keep in mind that we are still selling T-shirts as well as autographed copies of Scott's book, although he won't be able to fulfill those orders until June. We can do the T-shirts right away, though. There's the very hunky Ryan Milton modeling it. If you want muscles like that, buy this T-shirt.
Buy the shirt.
And
the shirt makes all the difference. That's the thing.
The very book in Russian that Scott is promoting right now in Russia, you can get in English at Scott Ritter Merch, autographed by Scott, in June. All right. What do you got live from the YouTube and Facebook crowd? Heather Fowler, do you think there will be an attack on U.S. soil after the most recent, quote, assassination attempt?
I'm just going to have to assume that the, quote, assassination attempt is, she's referring to as the drone attack on Putin.
Yeah, I think so.
But I mean, what's the linkage of an attack by the Ukrainians? So the Ukrainians tried to assassinate Putin. So now they're going to attack the United States. I don't think that's yet. Is that attack going to motivate others to attack the United States? I don't think America's enemy needs motivation from Ukraine if they want to attack us. You know, the...
Well, they may not need motivation, but it might make them think it's doable.
Well, here's the thing. First of all, it ain't doable because you're going to die. Okay. I can't speak on behalf of Russia. I don't want to speak on behalf of Russia. Russia solves Russia's problems. But I can pretty much guarantee you 100%. You attack the White House, you're dead. You're dead. That's just end of this story, dead kind of stuff. So, and I think everybody should know that. Don't attack the White House. That way, you know, and I know there's people out there, well, you attacked us, you bombed us. Yeah. Attack the White House, you're going to die. Understand, it's a one-way trip to hell. You ain't going to heaven. So don't attack the White House. And now Russia, in order to get that kind of certainty out there, needs to demonstrate that there are consequences for this kind of irresponsible and dangerous provocation.
Yeah, irresponsible to say the least. All right, what else we have? What has Scott heard on the ground about the attack and the Russian reactions?
I literally was at, when did I think we're at dinner last night when the my host showed me his cell phone and the news flash had just come in. And they, this is still early. I know the same thing everybody else knows. There's some concern, not concern, but I guess concern. Could this drone have been launched from Ukraine and reached Moscow? Well, I don't know what kind of drone it was. Does it have those kind of legs? how is the drone controlled? You know, because we found out, you know, when people were talking about, for instance, there's a drone attack on a Russian aircraft in Belarus. You know, it turned out that it was a bunch of locals who launched a drone close to the airfield and brought it in. You know, so is this drone something that was launched from inside Russia? If so, how did that happen? Was this drone launched from Ukraine? How did it get into Russia without being picked up? How was it guided to the target? I mean, it looked like it was zoomed right in on the Kremlin dome. So, you know, there's just a lot of questions out there that need to be answered. So I don't think I think most Russians are in the same position we are. We just don't know. Just don't know exactly what happened. And now everybody's waiting. And I think the Kremlin, before it, does a knee-jerk reaction, it seeks to define, because, you know, the old adage, you can't solve a problem that isn't properly defined, is at play here. You don't go around bombing willy-nilly, especially you don't go out and take out the Ukrainian government until you have absolute evidence that they're the ones who did that. I mean, right now, everything indicates, at least in my opinion, that they were behind it. You said you're going to do it. It got done. I'm blaming you. But I think that due diligence requires that a full investigation take place before you you take definitive action.
I'm trying to imagine how you and the others felt when you first saw the news. I mean, you're at dinner, you look at a phone. I don't know what exactly the headline said, but it would seem to me you would not really be able to ascertain the magnitude of it. You probably saw a headline that said something like the Kremlin was attacked.
Was it? Drug.
Yeah. Well, was it alarming? I mean, what was there panic or people took it?
Oh, God, no.
I'm sure nobody
panic.
Was happy, but I mean, you know.
I think it was, you know, the Russians don't panic. Again, that's another thing. In America, oh my God, the world's falling down. The Russians are like, all right, hey, okay, and get back to business. I mean, they got it, it registered, and then they moved on. That's just the way I see the Russians responding. There was no panic. There was no fear. There was just a resignation that, you know, we're at war, and this happens.
Okay. What else you got, Ann? Hey, our buddy Ricardo. Thanks a lot for your support, Ricardo. What's your favorite moment in Russia so far? Anything surprise your daughter? Two good questions.
Very, very, two very good questions. I mean, I really need to let Vika speak for Vika. I don't want to pretend that I think she has been overwhelmed with the hospitality, the overall hospitality of the Russians and just the experience. I mean, this is like you have to absorb a lot, especially if you didn't spend your life studying Russia. This is sort of a PhD level, investment into the accumulation of knowledge, the acquisition of knowledge. So I think sometimes she's just literally overwhelmed by it. But the thing that makes it doable is just how nice people are. I mean, they're just so nice, they're so friendly, so accommodating.
Does the average person there recognize you, Scott? I mean, I know that the people who attend the events obviously are there because they know who you are. But when you're walking around on the street, are you encountering people who maybe didn't even know you were in town, but they recognize you from the podcast or whatever?
Yeah. So, like I said, it's a little intimidating sometimes. But my favorite moment, that would be unfair because so far it's every moment's been my favorite moment. As it's happening, it's my favorite moment. There hasn't been an unfavorite moment. I wouldn't trade any moment for the other. It's impossible to do that. I mean, you know, today we're going to go out on Lake Baikal, which has been, you know, long been a dream of mine, not just mine, but Vika apparently has always been thinking about Lake Baikal. She studied it. So we're going to do that. And that's just going to be a spectacular experience, but you know, that's an experience. But going to the Khabarovsk Museum and seeing that was awesome. I didn't think it would have been awesome. It was awesome. Going to the monasteries were just mind-blowing. I mean, a really cool moment is when we got a personal tour of the Novosibirsk Opera by a former director who not only explained the whole opera, but then we got to go behind the scenes where nobody's ever been and see the, you know, the, how the stage is managed, you know, where the sets are stored, talked about the construction history, and you get to see all this stuff. I mean, it was just, again, everything's been good. I got a Banya, got beat to death by birch sticks. That was pretty cool too. Everything. There hasn't been a an experience that I wouldn't call just world class. This has been mind blowing, literally mind blowing. I think the Russian term would be umopomrachitsa, mind bending. And everything about this has just been mind bending. I'm really enjoying this a lot.
All right. I assume you're not going to recreate that experience of running naked down the street when it's freezing. What was that?
Thank goodness it's not it's not that cold right now. So yeah, there's no chance of recreating that experience.
I saw there was some snow the other day, though.
It did snow. We had snow coming down, but that was just a late flurry in Novosibirsk. There's no snow on the ground right now. I think there might be some residual ice in Lake Baikal, but it's rapidly melting. So it's
All right, let's try to squeeze a couple more questions in, and then we'll let you go to enjoy your day there. Will you be reconnecting with former Russian weapons inspectors? Another good question.
I certainly hope so. That would be one of the highlights of this tour. And I mean, this tour is full of nothing but highlights. Everything's been fantastic. But, you know, this is a book tour about a particular time in history, and that time involves, Votkinsk and the people that work there. And I am eternally hopeful that I will have a chance to meet up with these people and catch up with them and sit down and share drinks and tell lies and do everything that people do when they get together after years of not seeing each other.
I would imagine you made some friends who weren't weapons inspectors, too, some of whom might still be around.
Look, if I'm given the opportunity to go to Votkinsk, I would meet with everybody that, inspectors, civilians, citizens alike that I interacted with. And I'd like to meet the new citizens of Watkins, too.
All right. Did the Russians commemorate the anniversary of the Odessa massacre? Is this a nationwide day of mourning in Russia? What did you hear in Novosibirsk?
I can't say it was a nationwide day of mourning, but every Russian I spoke to was aware of what the day was and what had happened there. Again, this isn't a nation of emotional wrecks. These people aren't running around, overreacting to everything and pulling their hair out and being depressed. This is a nation of strong, resilient people who are resigned to the fact that their country is going through a very difficult time. And again, I mean, people need to understand that this war isn't something that generates the kind of hyper-patriotism that you might see in the United States. I haven't met a Russian yet that's thrilled about the opportunity to kill Ukrainians. It literally breaks their heart. This war is destroying their soul. Because you're literally killing yourself when you kill Ukrainians. That's the sentiment among everybody. There's no one here that says, yeah, let's do this, let's get it done. Yeah, hoorah, hoorah, USA, USA. All of it is, this is just so sad. And you get that when you talk to people here. It is so sad, this war. And it's surprised because people say, well, because you're not seeing the symbols of hyper-patriotism in place, that means that the Russians are against the war. The Russians are for defending Russia. And I think the United States and the collective West needs to come to grips with that reality too. These guys ain't backing down. They didn't start this fight, but they're going to finish it.
Are you detecting no opposition to the war from within Russia at all so far? None?
Oh, there's plenty of opposition to the war. I think even the people who support the necessity of defending Russia. Again, I think what I'm trying to get at is just because you're not pro-war doesn't mean you're anti-saving Russia. There just isn't that hyper-patriotism. There's some. I mean, you see some out there that are very gung-ho. But it's not the majority. But that doesn't mean that they're against Putin or against the war. It just means that this breaks their heart. This war is literally just... You got to be here to see it, Jeff. I don't know how to explain it. You got to see it. The resigned courage of the average Russian to wake up every morning knowing that there's... I'll give you a story. This is a short anecdote. Wagner was in a battle in Bakhmut, and they surrounded a unit of Ukrainians, and they basically it was surrender or die. So they shouted, "Hey, Ukrainians, surrender! Surrender is your last chance. Surrender!" And you know what the Ukrainians shouted back? "Russians don't give up. They're Russian. This is Russian fighting Russian." Okay, and if you don't understand that, you don't understand how this war is just ripping the soul of this country apart. But these are tough people; they're resilient people, and they're going to prevail. But they're confused. I gave a lecture the other day, and they asked the question about how do you define victory, and I said it's not my job to define victory; it's your government's job to define victory. And the fact that you're asking that question means your government's not doing its job. And there, the whole room just blew up. They're like, "Yeah, you're right." That boom. And what's that tell you? I mean, these people aren't against winning this war, but I think there is some frustration in Russia about the way the government is going about this victory. I don't think the government's done a good job of explaining the goals and objectives of this war to the Russian people. I do think that that's a major failing. That's something that I'm definitely picking up on, is a frustration of, you know, how does this end? What are we, the big one is, what are we fighting for? We know what we're defending. Okay, but now to achieve a victory, you have to tell me, you know, take Hill 861, take objective A, accomplish this. But right now you have people on the front lines who are just told, wake up in the morning and go to war. And I think that is a growing frustration. I think that the Russian government does need to do a better job of explaining this conflict to the Russian people, what their goals and objectives are. And I think that the fact that the Russian government isn't doing that just proves my point that this is a special military operation, meaning it was never designed to be a war. It was designed to have a negotiated outcome, but the United States and Ukraine and NATO don't want to have a negotiated outcome. And so now Russia is struggling to define what victory is. What is demilitarization? What is denazification? What does all this mean? They have concepts, but now they need to have definitions, because from the definition, you can get a goal, you can get an objective, you can have mission accomplishment. Right now, they just seem to be treading water, and it's very frustrating for the Russian people.
Okay. We, by the way, streamed that event in Novosibirsk when you were asked the question about how to define victory. And just to let our audience know, it's going to be a little unpredictable, but we'll try to stream some of the other events while Scott is there, and also do some more episodes of Ask the Inspector. Anything you can say about your availability at this point, Scott, or it's just going to be play it by ear?
Well, I think, you know, I have to be very respectful of my hosts and their schedules. You know, this morning we had a little bit of time available, so as I promised you, I would do my best to do it. And I imagine that going forward, there's going to be windows of availability, and as long as the internet connectivity is good, and here I am in Irkutsk streaming live, so it's okay. I think we'll be able to do this on a regular basis.
All right, good. Well, we have over 3,000 people watching live. So people got the word. We got the word out, you know, through Substack. I sent out a notice to all our subscribers, and we have a lot of people who subscribe to our YouTube channel. So whenever a stream is scheduled, they get notified. So we don't need that much time to get a big audience. We just proved it. Thank you for making time. And I know that you have a lot more sightseeing to do and work and all kinds of stuff.
Speaking of time, what time is it? Ooh, look at that watch. This watch has significance. Every Russian who sees this watch knows what this watch is. But this is a Commandeer watch made by the Vostok Watch Company, but it's an officer's watch. You could only get, when I was a weapons inspector, they had a military magazine store, commissary in Moscow. And it was only for Russian military personnel. So all of us U.S. military personnel would dress up like we were Russians, and not in uniform, but, you know, shapkas and coats. And we'd walk in looking grim, and we'd point and speak Russian and try and get stuff. And for the most part, they sold the shapkas and the belt buckles and all that stuff. But whenever we tried to get the watch, nope, you ain't getting the watch. So I got one. I got
all right.
Your watch.
And you have a gift for some people. I saw there was a little controversy on Telegram about somebody revealing what that is. I'm not quite sure I understand that. Are we able to?
There's always drama. This coin was of great controversy.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, I have to thank Alexandra on my Telegram channel. She helped me come up with the design. She did the design. She is the artist who designed this. She's awesome. And the idea was this was supposed to be a special gift that I would hand out in commemoration of this trip. Jeff got it.
Lucky number on it too. Thank you for that.
I did. I gave you your lucky number. I think what it was is that I just think there was a misunderstanding about the way it was. The idea was that this was supposed to be a spontaneous gift between me and the person getting it. But I don't know.
aren't you glad I asked? Sometimes I don't even understand all these controversies. All right. So anyway, no harm, no foul, as we say here in the U.S. You remember the U.S. You'll be back soon, and we'll have a gay old time. And look for us soon, and we don't know exactly when, but Scott will do his best. Thanks again to Ann Moss, who joined us on short notice, and to all our beloved audience for watching and donating. We appreciate it very much. Remember, a documentary is coming that will include a lot of footage from this trip. It's called Waging Peace. And you can support that project by donating at wagingpeace.fund. Take care, Scott. Say hi to Vika.
Thank you. Will do.